dopamine's effect on our normal nature without opening up the inner and higher ranges that are intermediate between our human condition and the supermind. We cannot think of it because even in the subliminal ranges, the action of supermind or even of overmind has not sufficiently found root. It has not been given a concrete basis, even in subliminal action. So it is asleep, belongs to the realm of Sushupti, not even of Swapna. So the two necessities he points out are the opening up of the intermediate ranges within and above. The intermediate ranges within come through a subtilization of the inner mind, inner vital, inner physical consciousness. The development of the yogic consciousness, which gives us access of control over the inner being. The gradual emergence of the psychic being. And the higher ranges opening up with the mind or inner mind receiving the influence from cosmic sources above it. Now, in dealing with this last aspect, Sri Aurobindo begins talking about what these spiritual experiences open up to. So, the idea of a change of nature through a deepening into the inner being, a living within, leads to a sense of the powers of spirit that can influence our existence through the inner being. As this develops, experiences come to us. And Sri Aurobindo talks about some of these experiences as, for example, the beginnings of the power of spiritualization. He gives some examples of these experiences as the silence of the mind, the admission of our being into the cosmic consciousness, the nirvana of the little ego and the sense of universal self, the contact with the divine reality, the interventions of the higher dynamics, and our openness to them. These experiences increase both these processes of these interventions and this greater openness. So at this point, he introduces the theme of the independent ranges of cosmic mind, because it becomes possible to be aware of something greater than our mental faculty through which these spiritual experiences are descending into us. So this he develops in terms of four major levels of cosmic mind, which, as he points out, need to be developed as intermediate stadia of human consciousness if we are to develop an integral being. Integrality requires the inclusion of these intermediate ranges. So he enters first into the discussion of the higher mind. This is where we were. And in this discussion of the higher mind, first, he points out that the higher mind is a vast cosmic mind of thought. That the very first distinction between the higher mind and even the highest mind of the human philosopher is its sense of vastness and infinity. Already we have entered into the cosmic ranges. And in our perspective on reality, it is as if this range can turn a variety of frames, all of them equally possible. So, to create conceptual frames, is something which arises as a result, not as a cause, but as a result of dwelling in this particular consciousness. It's native to its situation to produce these formalisms, if we call it that. So that is higher mind. And Sri Aurobindo goes on to say that higher mind is not only conceptive, it is also willing. That is, it has a power of will. This power of will, he points out, acts through the bringing of these concepts into contact with our life parts. And as we very well know, high ideals, great schema can inspire us when we come into contact with these through our emotions, through our will, and even through our physical power of doing things, our work. So this is how he develops the higher mind in its conceptive and willing parts. But he also engages a long discussion about the limits of these powers of consciousness. He points out that in its own native realm, it is perfectly a cosmic consciousness. But entering into the human consciousness, it is immediately subject to the relativism of ignorance. And hence, it is contested from all sides. And its light is immediately dimmed. So we find that it loses its most of its power, becomes distorted and deformed, and becomes only a probable guess, a doubtful guess, in a huge mass of obscurity. This is a condition which has to be fought. And the fighting of that condition is what he is calling a battle, where the forces of cosmic ignorance are arrayed against the possibility of the emergence of light. So that introduces the two different lines on which this journey is proceeding. Not only is it an individual journey, but it is also a journey to eradicate from the environment, from the milieu, as one may say, and even the majority, those forms which stand completely against the very possibility of the emergence of higher powers of knowledge. That is what he enters into for a while in this previous, I think, where the last paragraph before where we are. And yet, as he points out, even if we do manage to eradicate these forces, there is always the intermixture of the stuff of ignorance which obscures this power. And this power is not strong enough to change, modify, or transform this stuff of ignorance. So this is where we are at present. I just want to read the last part of that last paragraph to connect us with where we are. He says, it is here again, there's a very important point that he's making, which is with regard to the evolution of consciousness being also an evolution of power. That it is by the force of resistance that a certain aspect of evolution is also getting worked out. It is more of the nature and claim of any force in the manifestation to be, to survive, to effectuate itself wherever possible and as long as possible. And it is therefore that in a world of ignorance, all is achieved not only through a complexus, but through a collision and struggle and intermixture of forces. But for this highest evolution, it is essential that all mixture of ignorance with knowledge should be abolished. So this is a change of law. And we discussed this last time in terms of a change of law from the law of Rudra to the law of Vishnu. That no longer is it conflict that will suffice, but it has to enter into a phase of one last obscuration which is overcome. And then there is a development of harmony which takes us from light to greater light. So an action and evolution through strife of forces must be replaced by an action and evolution through a harmony of forces. But this stage can only be reached by a last strife and an overcoming of the powers of ignorance by the power of light and knowledge. In the lower levels of the being, the heart and life and body, the same phenomenon recurs and on a more intense scale. So at every level, on the mind level, on the heart and on the life levels, the same kind of contention has to be engaged. For here it is not ideas that have to be met, but emotions, desires, impulses, sensations, vital needs and habits of the lower nature. These, since they are less conscious than ideas, are blinder in their response and are more obstinately self-assertive. All have the same or a greater power of resistance and recurrence, or take refuge in a circumconscient universal nature, or in our own lower levels, or in a seed state in the subconscious, and from there have the power of new invasion or resurgence. This power of persistence, recurrence, resistance of established things in nature is always the great obstacle which the evolutionary force has to meet, which it has indeed itself created in order to prevent a too rapid transmutation, even when that transmutation is its own eventual intention in things.
Devachisa.
Yeah.
When you were speaking about the high mind, you were talking about how it's more than just being conceptual, but it also has the will in it. Could you expand on that? Because usually we associate the mind with more and more conceptualizations and not with any the will. And in fact, the experience is also that as you more and more mentalize yourself, the will is actually left behind. Of course, I understand the higher mind is probably not of the same material as the mind proper, so to say. But regardless, won't the same logic, so to say, apply?
No, because in a way, what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that the higher you go in the ranges of cosmic mind, the more they include of the power to influence and even identify with the other ranges of consciousness. Because they carry more and more some aspect of supramental possibility. So though at the level of higher mind, we may say it is only a shadow of that kind of possibility. Still, it has more of a power of will than what we experience as the abstraction of thought. See? So this conceptualization or this power of forming concepts is only one aspect of this large higher mind, because it carries within itself this invitation to experience the oneness of being. So these schemes that explain reality to us are nevertheless also schemes that inspire our growth towards some state of fulfillment, of totality. See? So that is why the conceptive schemes of the higher mind carry within themselves a certain type of inspiring capacity to the life forces in us. But still, this capacity is a kind of a influence which is different in nature from that of life. It isn't by close contact, which is native to life, that the higher mind acts upon the life. However, as you'll point out, the higher we go in these cosmic ranges, the substantiality of spirit also changes, so that there is a certain closer contact, intimacy, and even identity with other powers of the human consciousness. Just like the psychic has some closer contact with mentality, vitality, and physicality. So to the higher we go, the greater is this possibility of contact. Yet, it is not complete. It cannot enter into a full identification until we emerge in supermind. This is the point that he's making. Abstraction of thought yields to something which is more, full of light and life, the higher we go in cosmic mind.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hello? Oh,
okay.
Yes. Yeah, no, I just lost my connection. But in another way to think about Shyam's question, I was envisaging that this concept of knowledge, will, and power are essentially interwoven with the basic fabric of the universe, with Sachidananda. So at every level, from mind to supermind, there'll always be the knowledge, will, and power simultaneously. Is that right?
Yeah, this is right. But you see, there is a gap between knowledge and power in the ignorance. Yeah. The deeper the ignorance, the greater that gap. This gap is ultimately completely healed in supermind, where that's why Sri Aurobindo uses the term knowledge will with a hyphen in between. As it perceives, that is performed. You see, immediately what is perceived comes into existence, becomes, as it were. But the further we go into ignorance, this sort of coexistence of knowledge and will becomes more and more of a divided consciousness. There is a gap between them, and even a conflict between them.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if we could even will to, even in the current mental consciousness, if we are able to even will what we read, so to say, it would be a completely different sadhana, correct?
Exactly, exactly. That's where the problem lies. Our higher idealizations don't inspire our life energy sufficiently for us to embody them or effectuate them. See, the will does not adhere completely to what we know to be right. But from a practical point of view, one may say that if the power of idealism is strong enough, is inspiring enough, that's why we talk about human examples that can be inspiring. The reason human examples can be inspiring is because they carry that life energy with them. They bring into life, to their embodiment, certain powers of idea, which then inspire us in our will. However, higher cosmic powers, by their very nature, have that fire within them that can inspire through the life energy itself. So that is the difference. The higher we go, the greater the life content is to these idea forces.
Yeah, thank you, Devashisha. Sitaram, would you like to read?
This obstacle will be there. That is the paragraph, right?
Yeah, that's the paragraph.
This obstacle will be there. Even though it may progressively diminish at each stage of this greater ascent, in order to allow at all to the higher light an adequate entry and force of working, it is necessary to acquire a power of quietude of the nature to compose, tranquilize, impress a controlled passivity or even an entire silence on mind and heart, life and body. But even so, a continued opposition, overt and felt in the force of universal ignorance or subliminal and obscure in the substance energy of the individual's make of mind, his form of life, his body of matter, an occult resistance or a revolt or reaffirmation of the controlled or suppressed energies of the ignorant nature is always possible, and if anything in the being consents to them, they can resume dominance. A previously established psychic control is very desirable, as that creates a general responsiveness and inhibits the revolt of the lower parts against the light or their consent to the claims of the ignorance. A preliminary spiritual transformation will also reduce the hold of the ignorance. But neither of these influences altogether eliminates its obstruction and limitation. For these preliminary changes do not bring the integral consciousness and knowledge, the original basis of nascence, proper to the inconscient, will still be there, needing at every turn to be changed, enlightened, diminished in its extent and in its force of reaction. The power of spiritual higher mind and its idea force, modified and diminished as it must be by its entrance into our mentality, is not sufficient to sweep out all these obstacles and create the Gnostic being, but it can make a first change, a modification that will capacitate a higher ascent and a more powerful descent and further prepare an integration of the being in a greater force of consciousness and knowledge.
So here he provides us with a clear view of what it means to go through this transition from one law to the other law. And it also gives a very interesting insight into why we call the nature of existence, you know, sort of, I mean, under the aegis of the, you know, human condition, as ignorance. It is the avidya, ignorance, because here nothing is sure. Everything is a field of contested forces. And this creates a tremendous confusion in us. We can choose to, you know, empower one or other line as a relative truth. We can provisionally allow for something as a practical line of development. But nevertheless, there is no absolution to anything that we choose in the ignorance. Now, on the other hand, any experience, even that of the higher mind, coming with sufficient purity from above, from the cosmic mind planes, has to bring at some point into the existence of the human a taste of the absolute. See, this is a very important point. This taste of the absolute, whether it comes to us through the emergence of the psychic being or its recognition of truth or through some quality of consciousness that is experienced from above, from one of these cosmic planes, it brings us face to face with something that the ignorance of the human being is not familiar with. It is the sense that there is a truth with a capital T. It is not a set of small truths that are contesting with each other and will always remain in the ignorance as possibilities. But something in us recognizes that there is a truth with a capital T. Now, what that is, we may have no idea. But the taste for it develops because the intuition of it develops. And along with it comes the need for a new kind of law. That law is a, you know, is a greater growth into the consciousness of the spirit. For that, there has to be a change in the operation of the ignorance and its authorized conclusion. That's why he says over here, in the great insight he provides over here, is that it isn't by a warring of ideas, with the higher ideas, with lower ideas, that this transition from one law to another takes place. But it is a putting to silence of that other law completely. How are we to overcome that other law? It is through this suspension of its law, you see. And that's the reason why the more one awakes to the truth of the higher consciousness, the more the pressure arises within us to silence the noises of the ignorance. All this clamor and confusion, these doubts and variety of other possibilities that arise in us at whatever level, whether of the mind or of the choice of the will or of the emotions and their senses of their sense of desire, at each level there has to develop a certain kind of silence which completely puts to sleep all these clamoring voices of the ignorance. That's why he's talking here of this development as a very important one in allowing the growth of consciousness. In order to allow at all the higher light an adequate entry and force of working, it is necessary to acquire a power for quietude of the nature, to compose, tranquilize, impress a controlled passivity or even an entire silence on mind and heart, life and body. Again, we go back to that first need for a development of the inner being, which allows us control over the inner mind, life and body, the yogic consciousness. And then again, he points out that that is even further facilitated if the psychic being emerges. Or one may say, and or if spiritualization proceeds to a certain degree. That is, if some of the experiences that he's talking about, such as the silence of the mind or the entry into the cosmic consciousness, occur by descent of higher Shakti, then this bringing of a greater silence into the inner being becomes much more possible. So this is the point that he's making over here. But he goes on to say that even were that to happen, it's not going to ultimately change things, because it will only create a provisional degree of openness, receptivity, in which something higher may develop. But it cannot actually bring about a complete change, because the positive force that is responding to it from above is not strong enough. The higher mind cannot bring with it a power of modification that will replace the confusions of the ignorance.
So, Devaji, the one thing that I noticed, perhaps it's something that started in this paragraph or the last two paragraphs, is that somehow the tone has changed from more of metaphysics to more, you know, of practical advice. Do you see that, or?
Yeah, that is interesting, because this is the nature of the life divine, that it flows through a variety of terrain, you may say, in its presentation. Some of it is philosophical in that sense that it opens up these possibilities of concepts, and then some of them combine this conceptualization with some kind of seeing into practical psychology, as one might call it. It is necessary to do this, you know, because ultimately, even as a philosophy, this philosophy is a practical philosophy as well. The whole tenor of the philosophy is basically to point out that certain things cannot be understood even until some changes take place in us. So under that circumstance, there is a certain kind of a stress where there is a move from that sort of picture presentation to a, you know, sort of a kind of an injunction, one may say. And here is where, you know, we swing from domain of philosophy as basically metaphysics to a domain of philosophy which is closer to the Indian sense of darshan. That is that there are certain conditions that need to be sort of met to arrive at the perception that is being talked about.
Yeah, thank you, Debashishita.
Yeah, this is the reason why I think this point is a very important point, the point you make, because this is partly the reason why, a work like The Life Divine cannot be treated as a work of academic philosophy in the Western academy, see, because its disciplinary boundaries are quite different. You have to ask the question as to, is it then something quite different? Is it meant to sort of reside in a different kind of space altogether, just for, people who are open to a certain different view of reality and of the experience of reality? You see, philosophy, which is... sort of tied to the experience of reality. Now, that is the very nature of darshan. That is the meaning of darshan. It is philosophy which is tied to experience. Now, it's very interesting that today there's a lot of rethinking going on about things of this nature. And in fact, if any of you are familiar with, science, culture, and integral yoga, which I co-edit, I put up an article over there where this very question regarding Indian philosophy is being discussed. That is, in colonial times, around the time that Sri Aurobindo was writing, there was a whole new era of Indian philosophy in English that developed, which in a sense, Western academicians treat as something which doesn't fall into the disciplinary boundaries of philosophy at all. But today, there's a whole new rethinking that is taking place, which is showing how this kind of philosophy changes the limits of what is called philosophy. That its very basic understanding of philosophy is challenged to a large extent by this kind of philosophy, which will expand the scope of what we understand by the term philosophy.
So, Devashishtha, related to the previous paragraph, actually, the concept of law of Rudra and the law of Vishnu you mentioned, even here, it looks like at every turn, inconscient is going to be there, however diminished it is, it's going to be there. So, does it mean that the law of Rudra is going to be present?
It does mean the law of Rudra is going to be present, because I mean the replacement of that law cannot be complete until the supermind establishes itself. We could even say that the true law of Vishnu is the law of the supermind. But in the meantime, a transition takes place in which a greater and greater light replaces the action of the confused, sort of battle that is going on in the world at all times, and in each individual at all times.
Vince, would you like to read next?
Sorry, I was in mute. I muted instead of unmuting. I'm saying, I'm asking Devashish, could you just illustrate like few couple of lines or so on the law of Rudra that you're referring to?
Yeah, last time we talked about this, actually Sri Aurobindo refers to this in a few places, not many times, but in some, he refers to it in some of his thoughts and aphorisms, and he also refers to it very prominently in the essays on the Gita, where he uses this term, something like, the messengers of light have come and gone, but no peace can be until the heart of man deserves peace. Until then, it is Rudra that will hold the earth in the palm of his hands. Now, this particular passage is also kind of, you know, best seen side by side with other passages in which he contrasts what he calls the law of Rudra and the law of Vishnu. The law of Rudra is the law by which harmony gradually evolves through conflict in the ignorance. That is, through trial and error, through dissatisfactions, through fighting with one another, we are forced gradually to embrace something which unites us, which grows. This is the law of evolution in the ignorance. But the law of Vishnu is something in which an intuition of unity pervades the consciousness. And that, you mean, one may say, a kind of a critical turn has taken place in which whatever else one may do, there is a sense that, you know, we have to put at bay all our warring instincts and reduce them in the interests of a growing harmony. Because there is a power of harmony that will ultimately, you know, manifest. This is the basis of the law of Vishnu as compared to the law of Rudra, which doesn't even empower the possibility of a eventual harmony that can come. While in the law of Vishnu, there is almost a knowledge underlying civilization and in each individual that there is a power of harmony, and all we need to do is to, you know, put to rest in some way, put to, you know, silence if necessary, open ourselves to greater law so that that higher manifestation may occur.
What do you think that law of Rudra is like an ever conflicting, how does he relate to evolution without any higher law? I mean, evolving towards what?
But the evolution is almost invisible. You see, like for example, history shows us that mankind, even in its sense of identity, has grown to a greater degree in accepting other types of human beings, races and all that as being ultimately human. But it never wanted to do that. It isn't that it started with the idea that we are all human. It started with the idea that we are all different and we'll, you know, kind of destroy each other if necessary. But in that process of destruction, forces have come into play that have yielded a certain greater degree of unity. Now, still the degree of unity is always provisional because war is always lurking in the background. So the law of Rudra is a veiled law, a law that pushes towards unity without even our understanding that there is unity.
So in the law of Vishnu, that thing is absent, you mean? I mean, does it also include that as well?
Yeah, the real critical turn that takes place in the law of Vishnu is that there is an intuition in the hearts of the individual and of the race that unity is the law which binds us. You see, that switch takes place. After that, we may have differences, and our differences may cause us to, you know, be really against each other, etc. But still, you know, there is a certain critical turning that has taken place, which tells us that, you know, in spite of everything, we can find a solution. So the, you know, saying by the mother, for example, which exemplifies this very well, there is a saying by the mother in her four austerities and four liberations. She says, there is always a solution for people of goodwill. Okay? Now this statement, it's like a mantra, this she has again reiterated later, that after the manifestation of the supramental in 1956, this is even more so. You know, this is always true. So if people even open themselves to the fact that there is a solution, there will be a solution, you see. So that goodwill that she's talking about becomes a primary shift that takes place at certain point, which inaugurates the law of Vishnu. Even if there are differences, there is a goodwill and faith that there will be a solution.
Thank you.
So, for example, instead of going to war, let us go to the negotiating table. You know, it seems like a veiled thing, but if the goodwill is there, then mankind can work out their differences under various kinds of other less aggressive and destructive means and become more and more confident in the fact that solutions can be found, because ultimately goodwill unites the human race.
So basically what you were saying, the law of Rudra is that the water is lurking, that the veil will, that in the law of Vishnu it comes in the front and to some extent, and becomes, human beings become conscious of it in the mind. And
Exactly. That's the switch of the turn. A critical point of that coming to the front is reached, where sufficiently it becomes part of the surface nature, so that, you know, it cannot, you know, be pushed aside by the power of war, or power of, you know, destruction.
It's very beautiful, actually, also in reference to Veda, there was that you were talking about that law of Vishnu is like coming in the front. This harmonious vision. But also, I mean, also Vishnu is sort of can lead Indra as well, right? Which can put in lightning
flashes. Yes, absolutely, very true. These powers of the cosmic mind, that's where Indra comes in exactly. And we'll see right now that exactly where we are, this transition from the higher mind to the illumined mind, and beyond the illumined mind to the higher ranges of the intuition and the over mind. These are the ranges of Indra, where exactly these lightnings, you know, are sort of there to open up this law of harmony, which are ultimately coming from the law of Vishnu.
Devashista, does Sri Aurobindo talk of from what plane the avatar Sri Rama comes?
Well, no, I'm not really sure of that. He just says he's an avatar of the ethical mind.
Thank you, Devashista. Vince, would you like to read next?
Can you hear me? I'm not sure if I'm muted.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Okay, great. The greater force is that of the illumined mind, a mind no longer of higher thought, but of spiritual light. Here, the clarity of the spiritual intelligence, its tranquil daylight, gives place or subordinates itself to an intense luster, a splendor and illumination of the spirit, a play of lightnings of spiritual truth and power breaks from above into the consciousness and adds to the calm and wide enlightenment and the vast descent of peace which characterize or accompany the action of the larger conceptual spiritual principle, a fiery ardor of realization and a rapturous ecstasy of knowledge. A downpour of inwardly visible light very usually envelops this action. For it must be noted that, contrary to our ordinary conceptions, light is not primarily a material creation. In the sense, a vision of light accompanying the inner illumination is not merely a subjective visual image or a symbolic phenomenon. Light is primarily a spiritual manifestation of the divine reality, illuminative and creative. Material light is a subsequent representation or conversion of it into matter for the purposes of the material energy. There is also in this descent the arrival of a greater dynamic, a golden drive, a luminous enthusiasmos of inner force and power, which replaces the comparatively slow and deliberate process of the higher mind by a swift, sometimes a vehement, almost a violent impetus of rapid transformation.
So we see this transition that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, because higher mind brings a certain neutrality with it. We can put to silence some of the voices of confusion, and we can awake to a possibility of unity, but we can't put to real rest or silence beyond the possibility of threat, all these opposing forces of ignorance and the falsehood. Because it doesn't have a sufficient degree of positive energy to overcome the force of the ignorance. So though it has a neutrality of ignorance, a peace of ignorance, a lightness, neutrality of spirituality, the peace of spirituality or the wideness of spirituality, it doesn't have the force of the spiritual, so of the spirit. So here what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that the higher mind illumination or enlightenment can be likened to the daylight, which is an even suffusion of light. It's universal, it's everywhere. But we almost take it for granted. In comparison with the night, with the ignorance, it is a big change. But nevertheless, its uniformity is such that once it settles, there is a sense of something which is completely neutral, even toned, and doesn't have any force to it. Daylight is even a certain kind of grayness, from a certain point of view, because of its neutrality. Here we find that something greater than that, even toned possibility, starts emerging. And Sri Aurobindo in this paragraph enters into this beautiful discussion of the nature of light. Mm-hmm. He's talking here about the spiritual origin of light, the fact that light is really not material, and then converted symbolically by us to represent certain internal or mental phenomena which bring us greater understanding. Intelligence and understanding are what we usually relate to light. But what he's pointing out is that this is because intelligence contains light. Understanding comes with light. And this light, this phenomenon of light, grows to a much greater extent as one encounters these powers of the higher cosmic consciousness, so that one sees the light in one's inner vision. Thoughts come with light which actually illuminate the inner senses. It is exactly from this point that one starts finding that the doors of the senses which are turned without reverse their operations, and one starts seeing with the inner potential of the senses, the inner sight, or even the inner hearing, or the inner, everything else, taste, touch, etc., smell. Now, this operation of light from within, and that illuminates, that comes with its power of illumination, is much more intense than what comes with the higher mind. It comes with these flashes of lightning or these enormous effulgences that the ideas of the illumined mind bring. And he will point out that these powers are not conceptive but perceptive. Conceptive belongs to the world of thought, but a transition is taking place over here, not from the world of thought to the world of vision. Again, in terms of the world that these particular ranges are privy to, we are coming closer and closer to a world, a power of sound or of language or understanding, which is united or identical with the power of sight. That's the reason why in the tantric conception, this is the domain from which there begins the notion of begins the operation of Pashyanti Vak, the seeing word, the word that sees. So one enters into a realm in which knowledge is no longer thought but seen. It is a visionary knowledge that the higher mind brings, and this visionary knowledge comes with an illumination of the domain of knowledge, so that there is a sense of light radiating the darkness of confusion of realms of ignorance. Again, the discussion regarding Indra is very apt here, because as Sri Aurobindo, literally describes, this is the realm in which the lightnings of the spirit begin. You see, a play of lightning of spiritual truth and power breaks from above into the consciousness and adds to the calm and wide enlightenment and the vast descent of peace which characterize or accompany the action of larger conceptual spiritual principles. A fiery order of realization and a rapturous ecstasy of knowledge. So also we realize that if in these very terms that he's using, you can experience the life content of this particular plane of knowledge. This is not merely restricted to the mind as we understand it, which is a mind of thought, but it has in it power of life. Because it is fiery, it is lightning-like, it has this inspiring quality. This term that he uses over here, enthusiasmos. Enthusiasmos is a Greek term that Sri Aurobindo has used elsewhere. And it differs from enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is a much more superficial variety of emotion. It belongs to the emotional mind, while enthusiasmos belongs much more proper to the touch of the cosmic consciousness on the psychic being. it is the power of fiery insulation. Again, another thing that is carried in this paragraph, if we look at it from behind or under the surface, is a kind of transition that Sri Aurobindo refers to in the record of yoga in his own life. And that is with regard to the operation of the powers of the Shaktis. The power of the higher mind, which he described over there as this vast descent, the wide enlightenment, the calm and wide enlightenment, etc. He sort of describes or characterizes in the record of yoga as a certain phase in which he says the combined power of Maheshwari and Mahasaraswati are at work in his consciousness. But he says that this must seed to a new power, which is the power of Mahakali, acting in the consciousness. If things are to be achieved with speed, with intensity and speed, and the description that he gives shows very clearly that action of the Mahashakti, of Mahakali, from this illumined mind upward. That's why he says there is also in this descent the arrival of a greater dynamic, a golden drive, this golden light, the golden power of Mahakali is what becomes active, and he talks about it as a enthusiasm of inner force and power, which replaces a comparatively slow and deliberate process of the higher mind by a swift, sometimes a vehement, almost a violent impetus of rapid transformation.
Can we say that I'm just talking from my whatever I understand in practical situation is that when we are hit by some kind of resistance or some kind of battle, whatever it is, basically some kind of whether it's my perception or actual reality. Sometimes that power comes to sort of dominate it or put it down. What really happens then is that becomes too real, meaning that gets too much weight. In that plane of reality, smashing something down or something like that. Whereas Lord Vishnu, if it is coexisting, then it can sort of show its lightness at the same time, meaning it's a play and it's not the whole reality. And that if we talk about that Mahalakshmi, that is also acting behind from that point. And then if that happens, then that golden Mahakali can put its influence or sort of law. When that coexistence of this power of Rudra and the power of Mahalakshmi can act together without sort of losing their own planes.
Yeah, because you see, that's exactly how he's putting it, in the sense that first there has to be that very wide power of neutrality that ultimately, sort of puts everything in an even consciousness, equalizes everything, brings equality to the whole field. And only under that condition, this power of Mahakali can then act to intensify the force of a transformation. Because as he points out that equalization will neutralize or bring to a much less seriousness all these other powers that are contesting. They will not be able to completely disturb us, but neither will it be able to completely get rid of them, because there is no force to the power of this Maheshwari, Mahasaraswati evenness. So that's where, once that is established and coexists, then the Mahakali power can come in and act with force on these various constituents that need to be transformed.
Luis, would you like to read next?
Okay. The illumined mind does not work primarily by thought, but by vision. Thought is here only a subordinate movement expressive of sight. The human mind, which relies mainly on thought, conceives that to be the highest or the main process of knowledge. But in the spiritual order, thought is a secondary and a not dispensable process. In its form of verbal thought, it can almost be described as a concession made by knowledge to the ignorance, because that ignorance is incapable of making truth wholly lucid and intelligible to itself in all its extent and manifold implications, except through the clarifying precision of significant sounds. It cannot do without this device to give two ideas an exact outline and expressive body. But it is evident that this is a device, a machinery. Thought in itself, in its origin on the higher levels of consciousness, is a perception, a cognitive seizing of the object or of some truth of things, which is a powerful but still a minor and secondary result of spiritual vision. A comparatively external and superficial regard of the self upon the self, the subject upon itself, or something of itself as object, for all there is a diversity and multiplicity of the self. In mind, there is a surface response of perception to the contact of an observed or discovered object, fact or truth, and a consequent conceptual formation of it. But in spiritual light, there is a deeper perceptive response from the very substance of consciousness and a comprehending formulation in that substance, an exact figure or revelatory ideograph in the stuff of the being. Nothing more, no verbal representation is needed for the precision and completeness of this thought knowledge. Thought creates a representative image of truth. It offers that to the mind as a means of holding truth and making it an object of knowledge. But the body itself of truth is caught and exactly held in the sunlight of a deeper spiritual sight, to which the representative figure created by thought is secondary and derivative, powerful for communication of knowledge, but not indispensable for reception or possession of knowledge.
So this is a really interesting discussion on the difference between vision, thought, and word, both in the truth and in the ignorance. So he's pointing out, in the ignorance, these are three different things, and there is a certain gap in them. And there's a very interesting discussion of this by the mother, again, in the four austerities and the four liberations, where she says, the austerity of speech, she's talking about the austerity of speech, She discusses how the more ignorant a person is, the more dependent such persons are on speech even to arrive at thought. See, she says that there's a lot of people who can't even think unless they speak about something. So it is through the externalization of speech that they arrive at some sense of thought. These are the people who are talking all the time. Even when they work, they talk to themselves. In their mind, they tell themselves what it is they are doing. Because otherwise, the idea of what they should do doesn't come to them clearly. Then there's another kind of person she talks about who feels that as they talk about something, it gets clearer in their minds. So they repeat themselves a lot. They say something, then they're surprised by what they said, and they repeat again, and this time it becomes a little clearer to them. And then through number of repetitions, they get the idea of what they're trying to say. So here she points out that if, on the other hand, one was not dependent on the word for arriving at a sense of the thought, this gap was completely removed, then one would see that the conversion of thought to word takes place in a very essential sense, somewhere in the inner senses of the inner mind by the entry of a perception. Something comes from above which shows us, that is the idea. The idea, in its essence as conception, is actually a perception. That perception then clothes itself into words, and in its very height, that particular conceptive, quality is what we call a thought. Then that thought starts expressing itself in a variety of formulations, which are various sentences and words that we create out of the thought. Now, in this higher reality, there is a sense of oneness that pervades. It is the self, and everything is perception of self as its own objectified reality. So this is related to what Sri Aurobindo has called prajnana. It is the holding of the parts of the self in at an objectified distance so as to know it as object. And that knowledge is a perception. It is the perception of parts that the self knows its own, sort of self. So that's where he's pointing out over here that the nature of thought of the higher mind is much more clearly that of perception, that it is a vision, that it does not depend on thought or word. And if it has thought of conceptual and verbal quality to it, those qualities are fused with it. It isn't as if they are separate from it. That's why we may call it the seeing word, paschantiva. The word in itself, visionary. But the vision is its essence.
I have two questions that come to my mind. That one is this question that you were talking about, that the word, does it not have its own, does it have its own plane that can coexist with the thought plane, or ultimately thought has to superseded this plane?
It is not really superseding it, it is coexisting. So, you see, because again there are different schema in which the goddess of the word is also prioritized. So actually one may say that from this level on, from the level of paschantiva on, seeing and hearing are fused. So paschantiva is an example where the word and the thought and the seeing are one, you may say.
Right. Basically, that's what I was thinking. So it is no longer called as thought, it can be called as thought, right, in that thing.
Yeah.
And one more question I had about this Rudra, knowledge by identity, does it not have a relationship with this law of Shiva?
Yeah, you could say that. Absolutely, it could be said. You see, and then, the distinction between law of Rudra and law of Vishnu is only one way of conceiving this whole thing. There are, in fact, places where Sri Aurobindo has talked about Shiva and Rudra as the two faces of the same Godhead. And it, again, the same way in which I think you are trying to point out that Rudra is the action of violence which is necessary in the ignorance to bring it to a certain point, and after that Shiva is the action of harmony which leads it to identity.
Keka, do you want to read the next one? Keka?
I think you must be muted because we can't hear you.
Who are you talking to?
We were asking if you want to read next.
You were asking, I cannot hear clearly. You were asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. Okay. Yeah, this is the paragraph starting a consciousness that proceeds.
Yes. Consciousness that proceeds by sight, the consciousness of the seer, is a greater power for knowledge than the consciousness of the thinker. The perceptual power of the inner sight is greater and more direct than the perceptual power of thought. It is a spiritual sense that seizes something of the substance of truth and not only her figure. But it outlines the figure also and at the same time catches the significance of the figure. And it can embody her with a finer and bolder revealing outline and a larger comprehension and power of totality than thought perception can manage. As the high mind brings a greater consciousness into the being through the spiritual idea and its power of truth, so the illumined mind brings in a still greater consciousness through a truth sight and truth light and its seeing and seizing power. It can effect a more powerful and dynamic integration. It illumines the thought mind with a direct inner vision and inspiration, brings a spiritual sight into the heart of a spiritual light and energy, into its feeling and emotion, imparts to the life force a spiritual urge, a truth inspiration that dynamizes the action and exalts the life movements it infuses into the sense a direct and total power of spiritual sensation, so that our vital and physical being can contact and meet concretely, quite as intensely as a mind and emotion can conceive and perceive and feel the divine in all things. It throws on the physical mind a transforming light that breaks its limitations, its conservative inertia, replaces its narrow thought power and its doubts by sight, and pours luminosity and consciousness into the very cells of the body. In the transformation by the higher mind, the spiritual sage and thinker opined his total and dynamic fulfillment. In the transformation by the illumined mind, there would be a similar fulfillment for the seer. The illumined mystic, those in whom the soul lives in vision and in a direct sense and experience, for it is from these higher sources that they receive their light, and to rise into that light and live there would be their, and to rise into that light and live there would be their ascension to their native empire.
So, yeah, we find here that Sri Aurobindo is, you know, really with great eloquence showing the powers of these spiritual, you know, mind planes and their energies, their forces. In the very previous paragraph, this whole idea about vision and thought, I think it's captured well, where he points out that in the ignorance, thinking is like a figure, a representation of what is seen. Something is seen in inner mind, but it is then converted into an outline or representation in concept. And that is then converted into a figure in words. So this, you know, translation, triple translation as it were, does not occur to illumined mind. Illumined mind is primarily sight. That's why its perceptual quality is never compromised by its expression. So that's why he calls it a consciousness that proceeds by sight. This also, in this paragraph, becomes very clear, is the origin of what the Vedas call the Kavi, the poet. So this Kavi is also the seer. That's Rishi is the Kavi. Seer or Rishi is the same as the Kavi. So that's where the word Pashyanti Vak is, Pashyanti part refers to the Rishi or seer. Vak refers to the Kavi or poet. So the seer poet is the one who, you know, belongs to this particular kind of plane of consciousness. And he contrasts in this particular paragraph the operation of the illumined mind with the operation of the higher mind. There too, the Veda has a term, it is Manusi. Manusi is the thinker. So the thinker also has a certain amount of light. It's the light of the conceptive mind. That is the power of the higher mind. It also has a transformative power. As you pointed out, there is a will to it. But that will is the will of the idea, which can inspire from a distance, as it were. Its light is the light of a borrowed source, which the vital and the emotions and the will and the body feel only in reflection, as it were, as a reflected reality. But with this illumined mind, there is a more direct contact of the substance of spirit in the vital, in the emotions, in the will, and in the body. And so that's why he points out that it is a much more powerful transformative force than that of higher mind. And this transformative force acts directly. So this is what is really interesting and important to realize, that the higher the range of cosmic mind, the more direct their action on the entire being. And so the power for integration and for the development of an integral consciousness is much greater. Yet, it is not absolutely complete.
You mean, Veda, that it's full of imageries, right? And at the same time, it is all it is hymns, hymn after hymn, which is basically that, utterance. So it's like invocation and singing. I mean, it's like singing and invoking it at the same time. Just thought of it.
Yes, no doubt. That's exactly how it operates, both as something which is seen, something which has an idea behind it, because you can then understand something like an idea, and something which also inspires us with what he's calling the enthusiasmos. It is an invocation that directly goes into the heart. And then, as he's pointing out over here, that's exactly where the Veda has the mantric power, which has a material effect. It has an effect on the cells of the body. This is something the mother also repeats again and again, the power of the mantra to have a material effect. And so he says over here that not only does it have some power on the mind, but on all the other parts, and it infuses into the sense a direct and total power of spiritual sensation, so that our vital and physical being can contact and meet concretely quite as intensely as the mind and emotion can conceive and perceive and feel the divine in all things. It throws on the physical mind a transforming light that breaks its limitations, its conservative inertia, replaces its narrow thought power and its doubts by sight, and pours luminosity and consciousness into the very cells of the body. So this is this tremendous amount of transformative potential down to the cells of the body that utterance and sort of energy of the higher mind can bring. And then he goes on to talk about how this is really the fulfillment of the seer, of the illumined mystic, and how this sort of invites the consciousness to rise to its own form. And this is exactly what he was talking about regarding change of status of the consciousness, which ultimately, by the power of ascent, resides above the mind in these new centers of consciousness above the mind.
So Devashishtha, earlier in this chapter also, I believe, and elsewhere, he says that when these powers act, so they get deformed by the ranges in between. Is that true even here? Like when the illumined mind, when he's saying about how its impact on even the physical mind, so they all kind of modulated based on their own powers, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it has a greater transformative force on all these other layers, but nevertheless, it can't completely change their law, and it does get deformed. At every level, it gets deformed. So it can give much greater aspiration to the entirety of the being. It can integrate the lower nature into a higher kind of consciousness, but it cannot completely transform it, and it does get distorted in each medium of the ignorance.
And the illumined mind is where he's saying this sight versus thought, the change comes. Like the illumined mind is what he's calling where the sight is, and before that, the higher mind, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
okay. Thank you. Shall I read the next one?
Yeah, sure.
But these two stages of the ascent enjoy their authority and can get their own united completeness only by a reference to a third level. For it is from the higher summits where dwells the intuitional being that they derive the knowledge which they turn into thought or sight and bring down to us for the mind's transmutation. Intuition is a power of consciousness nearer and more intimate to the original knowledge by identity, for it is always something that leaps out direct from a concealed identity. It is when the consciousness of the subject meets with the consciousness in the object, penetrates it, and sees, feels, or vibrates with the truth of what it contacts, that the intuition leaps out like a spark or lightning flash from the shock of the meeting. Or, when the consciousness, even without any such meeting, locks into itself and feels directly and intimately the truth, or the truths that are there, or so contacts the hidden forces behind appearances, then also there is the outbreak of an intuitive light. Or again, when the consciousness meets the supreme reality or the spiritual reality of things and beings and has a contactual union with it, then the spark, the flash, or the blaze of intimate truth perception is lit in its depths. This close perception is more than sight, more than conception. It is the result of a penetrating and revealing touch which carries in it sight and conception as part of itself or as its natural consequence. A concealed or slumbering identity, not yet recovering itself, still remembers or conveys by the intuition its own contents and the intimacy of its self-feeling and self-vision of things, its lights of truth, its overwhelming and automatic certitude.
So here we begin coming into the domain of knowledge by identity, because that's where we find that the distance between the reception of vision and the knowledge of self is bridged. It is not as if there is a certain reception of a seeing that is coming to us from some great height, but there is a sense that we already know, just as the sight preceded the thought, here the identity precedes the sight. It is because of knowledge that we see. That becomes the primary source, and the intermediate quality between identity and sight is what Sri Aurobindo is calling intuition. That's why intuition is a very major cusp in the journey towards the full knowledge by identity. It stands over here as carrying a much greater sense of identity and pulling vision and thought along with itself. You know, vision and thought are seen from here as derivative powers of a knowledge by identity, which is not yet fully received as identity, but evident as self-evident almost as identity. The other interesting thing over here is his use of the term memory, a concealed or slumbering identity, not yet recovering itself, still remembers or conveys by intuition its own contents and the intimacy of its self-feeling and self-vision of things, its light of truth, its overwhelming and automatic certitude. And here, there is a very interesting discussion that he has relative to the record of yoga, where he kind of reverses the traditional relationship, hierarchic relationship between Smriti and Shruti. Shruti is supposed to be greater and Smriti is supposed to be, you know, inferior. In our theory of knowledge, in the Indian scheme, but from inner point of view, he relates this action of the higher mind and the illumined mind more to the domain of Shruti, that is revelation or inspiration, something which is coming from somewhere and giving us, granting the boon of revelation. But close to the heart of truth, to the heart of identity, what begins to occur is no longer a revelation but a remembrance. One remembers the fact that one already knows. So this is where Smriti in a sense precedes Shruti and belongs more properly to the domain of intuition where there is a remembrance of identity that brings revelation. So that's how there is an even deeper closeness, native, familiarity with a form of identity.
Probably it refers to a Sriti, before Sriti, meaning which the Sriti of something before manifestation, in other words. So is that what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It is the Sriti before the Sruti, almost.
Sitaram, do you want to go next? Are you there?
But these two stages, right?
No, it starts with,
The paragraph.
No, the next one, right?
In the human
in the
mind.
Mind the
in the human mind.
Okay. In the human mind, the intuition is even such a truth remembrance or true conveyance, or such a revealing flash or blaze breaking into a great mass of ignorance or through a veil of innocence. But we have seen that it is subject there to an invading mixture or a mental coating or an interception and substitution. There is too a manifold possibility of misinterpretation, which comes in the way of the purity and fullness of its action. Moreover, there are seeming intuitions on all levels of the being which are communications rather than intuitions, and these have a very various provenance, value and character. The infrarational mystic, so styled, for to be a true mystic is not sufficient to reject reason and rely on sources of thought or action of which one has no understanding. He is often inspired by such communications on the vital level from a dark and dangerous source. In these circumstances, we are driven to rely mainly on the reason and are disposed even to control the suggestions of the intuition or pseudo-intuition, which is more frequent phenomena. By the observing and discriminating intelligence, for we feel in our intellectual part that we cannot be sure otherwise what is the true thing and what the mixed or adulterated article or false substitute. But this largely discounts for us the utility of the intuition. For the reason is not in this field a reliable arbiter, since its methods are different, tentative, uncertain, and intellectual, seeking, even though it itself really relies on a camouflaged intuition for its conclusion, for without that help it could not choose its course or arrive at any assured finding. It hides this dependence from itself under the process of a reasoned conclusion or a verified conjecture. an intrusion passed in judicial review by the reason ceases to be an intrusion and can only have the authority of the reason for which there is no inner source of direct certitude. But even if the mind became predominantly an intuitive mind, reliant upon its portion of the higher faculty, the coordination of its cognitions and its separated activities, for in mind these would always be apt to appear as a series of imperfectly connected flashes, would remain difficult so long as this new mentality has not a conscious liaison with its suprarational source or a self-uplifting access to a higher plane of consciousness in which an intuitive action is pure and native.
So, in this paragraph, rather lengthy paragraph, Sri Aurobindo foregrounds the problem that Shyam had raised about the deformation or distortion of these things in the other parts of the consciousness. And he also makes another very important distinction about what is the intuition and the many other things that are called intuition by normal human beings. And there he's talking about what he puts in quotes as the infrarational mistake. Of course, in today's world, that term has taken an even more dangerous turn in that it is now called the psychic. These are the psychics of today, the infrarational mystics. Now, what he points out about this kind of operation is that these shouldn't be called intuitions at all, but they should be called communications. Communications because we are constantly receiving messages from a variety of sources around us which are occult in nature. And mostly these communications are coming from the vital. So again, this discussion is related to the whole idea of Smriti and Shruti. That is, Shruti, if we don't understand what the source is, there can be a number of sources of communication and even what we might think to be revelation. These are coming from a variety of places and we take it for granted that we are receiving some great message. But the surety of knowing whether something is intuitive or not is to be developed firstly by some kind of access to a quantity of light. So that's why he's pointing out, when he talks about the illumined mind itself, that there is a truth to light which is beyond what we take to be, an external phenomenon. But also the sense of identity. True intuitions carry with them this quality of the smriti. It is as if I always knew. It comes with that sense that it was always there. It partakes of the nature of eternity. That sense that puts into place, that brings certitude with it as to something which exists, does not sort of come as a flash, or it may come as a flash, but does not come as a flash in the pan. It isn't it's a violent surprise of some kind. So that is one thing. But the other thing that he's pointing out over here is that apart from the difficulty that comes from the various different parts, the different laws of the nature, which distort these things and put them at the same level, so to say, as all these other communications. There is also another problem, which is the problem that these intuitions come in flashes. They don't come steadily. They come with gaps between the various coordinations in our nature, in our operations. And hence, there has to occur a development whereby these flash intuitions can be related to another steadiness. And just as there is a steady daylight to the higher mind, there is another level of steady, intense light, which belongs to overmind and ultimately to supermind. That's why these ranges of lightnings, the lightnings of Indra, are not sufficient to replace the operations of the reasoning mind. So we have to take the help of the reasoning mind in this process of transition, and yet at the same time, reasoning mind is a completely different law, which ultimately has to recognize that the intuition is behind it. That part of the discussion is also very interesting, and we find that that is the case a lot in today's world, when there is much discussion going on about what is called artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, it is found, is something that occurs very different from human intelligence. It is not that what we call reason is a mechanical series of logical steps. That's what computers do. And that's why it takes computers so much more processing to arrive at a decision, or even to arrive at a recognition of what something is, pattern recognition of what something is, when these same processes occur in a flash in the human mind. So recognition of the intuitions behind the reasoning mind and the gradual coming to predominance of this power of intuition in its relationship with thinking is one of the things he's talking about over here. But he's also talking about the fact that until and unless there is the full purification of the being, there cannot be pure access to these intuitions unless we rise above the mind to the form of these intuitions. See? Always the intuitions we receive are already conditioned by the ignorance and the various accretions of ignorance that belong to the instruments which accept these intuitions. So there too, even if we can clarify the other kinds of communications that pass by as intuitions, still we will not arrive at the purity of the intuition until and unless we can arrive at the form of the intuition itself.
That purification is always that caveat to it, right?
So the intuitions are subjected to the, at least initially, need to be subjected to the rational mind.
Yeah, he is saying that, and at the same time he's pointing out that if you subject intuitions completely to the rational mind, then they cease to be intuitions. So they have to have an independence, but at the same time they have to be supplemented in these initial phases by the operations of the rational mind. And the relationship of the two should develop in such a way that rational mind itself realizes that to its own operations, intuition is at work.
In fact, this kind of, it seems to me at this time, that this kind of intuitions, they also develop, I mean, you know, help develop a more robust rationality and, you know, wider rationality.
Exactly.
Because you see, these intuitions and the relationship of the intuitions with the rationality is in that the intuitions illumine a very wide ground. And the ground that is illumined is a ground that is illumined in terms of its relations. Everything is related in certain ways. Rationality ultimately is powerful because of its relational capacity. It can establish links and can describe things in an ordered fashion. So this is exactly why the two are very closely related. I mean, the intuition illumines the heart of the rational process. That's why he's pointing out where rationality itself realizes that, you know, in its operations, behind its operations, the intuition is at work. So So the two help each other, and in that sense, it's very different from the kind of communications that pass for intuitions in the normal, what he's calling the infrarational mystic. In fact, this paragraph actually is a very profound paragraph, and I think maybe it's a good one for us to contemplate, and you know, maybe if there's anything more to be said next time, we could talk further about it, because this paragraph relates to the central problem of knowledge. This is the very reason why the whole modern age has been spawned on the basis of reason, on the basis of thinking rationally, because you know, of the tremendous dangers of the infrarational intuition. The whole, what are called the dark ages, are based on too hasty an access to these various kinds of communications. And, you know, the whole idea of throwing them out completely, because we can't be sure of them, and great danger can come from this lack of surety, marks our modern age. This is the reason why the modern age is so suspicious of ideas such as that of intuition. But at the same time, there has to be some kind of transition in which the relations between the rational mind and the intuition are put in the right place if we are to evolve out of this present state. So that's why this paragraph is so very important.
That rationality itself is something, but the how, what is using rationality is also important, right? Like, ego can use rationality, infrarational visions can use rationality, meaning sometimes the usage of rationality, sort of narrows down the definition of rationality.
Definitely. That's the reason why rationality also has to purify itself. And has to, you see, that's why in this relationship between rationality and intuition, both ultimately merge only through a certain process of yoga in each of them. Rationality itself has to purify itself, ultimately becoming nothing else than intuition. Intuition has to enlarge itself until it steadies itself in the full gaze of the overmind, where it's no longer fascist, but everything is understood from a higher sight. So I think in both cases, there is a long journey, as it were, that is to be taken in the relation between the reasoning mind and the intuition.
So shall we stop here and continue next time? So let's end with a brief meditation.